The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
I need you to knock some sense into me. I'm sure you can.
Yeah, I don't know.
I enjoy listening to you. I don't always agree with everything.
All right, enough of this persiflage.
So, you want my question?
I'm certainly not going to get myself in trouble by telling you what to do.
That makes great sense. Gosh, that's good.
That I overwhelm you with words and wisdom?
I've got 7 kids. I feel like I could call you every day.
Wait, you're telling me I'm wrong? Disconnect.
Yes, I am, Dr. Ray.
You just need to tune in to Dr. Ray, honey. She's got all the answers.
Am I right or am I right?
Probably.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Well, it's happened. I finally made it. I have enough money right now to last me the rest of my life. Unless I want to buy something. Then I'll fall short. Good to have you here. This is The Doctor Is In. The variant of The Doctor Is In is E-Person Monday. Had to find a way to address, I used to say tackle, but again, get in trouble using that kind of rough language, to address the E-persons, and I used to say email, no longer, it's E-person, being linguistically sensitive, that again, on a daily basis, not only from the radio program here, but from Living Right with Dr. Ray, as my producer on the program says, we want to hear from you. And apparently some people take us at our word, and they write in. So I had to find a way to address some of these E-persons. Many of them are just simply asking for a referral of someone in the area that I might know of, or a referral for a particular book. Some of them make a comment about a previous caller. Every so often, get somebody who disagrees, or in the worst case, gets upset and angry. And I've told my wife many times, please, honey, don't email me. Just if you have the problem with something I said, just talk to me. It's easier that way. We can interact. So I will get to those. But of course, the opening monologue. Situation occurs in my office where someone, let's say it's a guy, leaving his wife and his kids. And this guy has always looked like he's been relatively faith-filled Catholic or religious person. And his reputation around the community and his own family is that he's reliable, he's trustworthy, he's a good husband and father. And lo and behold, he wants out of the marriage. And he wants out of the marriage because he's met someone. Or he's pursued someone, it's more likely the case. Or someone pursued him. And then the conclusion that's stated often is something like, that's not who he is. I don't understand that. That is not at all who he is. And I can't come right out and say what I want to say, but over time it does trickle out. Who is it? Obviously, that is who he is, given those circumstances. Given the fact that this particular woman entered his life, or this particular woman was in his work environment, or this particular woman pursued him, that's who he is. When we say that's not who somebody is, what we're saying is the impression I have formed of them, what I know of them, and what I see rightly or wrongly as consistency in their morality or their conduct is who they are. And if they act counter to that and egregiously counter to that, it throws us. Some time back, there were a number of high profile religious figures, some of whom were Catholic, who spoke so very well about the faith. Preaching was very powerful. Had a high profile, holy image, if you will. And then it was found out that they did certain things that led to their downfall, significant downfall. And people would say, that's not who he is. And for me as a psychologist, I didn't have as much trouble accepting what they did, not accepting it morally, but accepting it in the sense of not being shaken by it, because I recognize that given certain circumstances, people can relent. They can yield to the temptation. If those circumstances wouldn't have happened, or if in fact that was who they were, but they were keeping it hidden, then, yeah, you wouldn't have come across this particular discrepancy in their personality, if you will. Remember one time a detective was asked in an interview, who kills people? And he said, who would kill people would surprise you? It's not people you would think. Now, granted, there's an awful lot of gang violence. There's an awful lot of unstable life violence. But there is also an awful lot of spouses and boyfriends and, to some degree, girlfriends killing each other, ex-spouses. And their image in the community is very high. If you watch any of these exploring crime shows that talk about the circumstances of a marriage, and then someone is killed, and as they pursue who did it, oftentimes the picture that most people had of their relationship was very positive, was very good. Wouldn't expect it. And granted, behind the scenes it wasn't anywhere near that good, but to the image, it certainly looked very, very loving. How could this be? So when you say that's not who he is, what you're really saying is that's not my impression of who he was. Or that's not consistent with who I thought he was. The church in her wisdom teaches to avoid the near occasions of sin. Because they recognize that put in certain circumstances, we can fall. We can act counter to everything that we believe or everything that's dear to us. Or we can act counter in ways that will ultimately sabotage our contentment, our walk with God. That's part of the human condition, unfortunately. And what makes a truly moral person, one following Christ, is one who consistently, across situations, behaves in a certain way. A small example of this, much more common example, is a teacher who absolutely loves a particular child, thinks this child is polite, kind, very popular with the other kids. And it just so happens that this child at home is a hellion, plays his parents terribly. But the teacher would be shocked. She'd say, that's not who he is. That's not how I see him. Well, yeah, it is. Given those circumstances, for whatever the reason, given parents' weak discipline or permissiveness or unstable family life, whatever it is, that's who he is at home. That is who he is at home. Who he is at school may be very different. That rocks parents. They can't understand why this kid would have a Jekyll Hyde personality. He doesn't. But he's doing, in many respects, what the situation has allowed or has contributed to. Sometimes a hurting spouse will say, "That I don't understand it. That's not the person I know." There's two answers to that. One, you didn't know that person through and through. Or two, up to that point in their lives that was the person you know, but it no longer is.
Well, then, Dr. Ray, how can you trust anybody?
Well, at some level, we do trust. And when it happens that our trust is broken, then we can be shocked, depending upon how we saw that other person consistently. It's Psych 101. Our behavior varies wildly from circumstance to circumstance. You know, there are people in your life who do not like you. And there are other people in your life that absolutely think you are a saint. How is this? Well, perhaps your conduct is different with them. With one person, you're very relaxed and easy. With the other person, you're on edge, you're nervous, you don't relate to them well, whatever it is. And the one person would say, well, that's not who they are. You may think they're a nice person, but that's not what I see. It's not who they are. Yeah, it is. It's who they are given different circumstances. Who else is it going to be? When we come back, your e-persons.
What's the deal with Dr. Ray? I mean, is he a psychologist or a comedian?
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Do you feel as though life is flying past you? Are you desperate for a way to find moments of peace and quiet? Lord, teach me to pray. The free Ignatian Prayer Series will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Brought to you by the nonprofit Seton Home Study.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. You want to pass the Catholic faith on to your children? A very good way is to teach your children at home. You want to protect your kids from the toxic culture that surrounds us? Do you want to have a greater influence in what your kids are learning? Once more, a great way is to teach your children at home. No teacher is going to care about your kids as much as you do. Seton Home Study School is the best way to teach your children at home. Go to setonhome.org. setonhome.org. I always wanted to be somebody. Should have been more specific, though. Thank you for joining me here. It's Dr. Ray Guarendi, program Doctor is In, co-production EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Ave Maria Radio Communications. Right now, over there in Ann Arbor, my compadre, the man who operates the boards and does all these buttons, pushings, and everything else that he has to do to keep this program on the air, Eric Dumont. My daughter was physically abused by her husband. They are now going through a divorce. They have three teenage kids. My other daughter has not yet told her children about that divorce. 12-year-old girl, 8-year-old boy. What is the best way to explain this without frightening them or creating anxiety that the very same thing could happen to their parents? Several things. One, I always get nervous when somebody says, what is the best way? Because it's not a one-size-fits-all. Depends upon the kid. Depends upon the parent. Depends upon the situation. Really depends. I mean, there are ways that obviously can work better than others, and sometimes you don't know what those are until after you do it. And then you realize, well, that didn't work out too well, but since you're not God and you can't anticipate every molecule of everybody's existence, you're forced to do your best judgment. Now, that said, she hasn't told the 12-year-old girl and the 8-year-old boy yet that their aunt and uncle are going to be separating. The 12-year-old girl has more of a chance of understanding this at a more sophisticated level, obviously. A few points to make. You don't need to get into the ugly nitty-gritty of why the marriage ended. You can be general. Something like, Aunt Susie, Uncle John, will no longer be married. They somehow realized that things weren't working, and they're going to be separating and splitting. That's tragic. You kids don't ever have to worry about that with us. The one thing you can know for sure is that we're not going to do that. Now, if the 12-year-old says, yeah, but they probably thought they weren't going to do it either, and you can be a bit honest. You can say, well, they've had a lot of struggles for a long time. We don't have those struggles. We have a very solid relationship. We love each other very, very much. That's the last thing you kids would ever have to worry about. And then if the 12-year-old girl wants to keep getting reassured, yeah, but I'll bet their kids didn't worry about it either. Well, I think their kids saw a lot of the problems their mom and dads were having. And the problems they were having were nothing like what we're having. We have no problems like that. Nothing at all like those problems. So sometimes, very, very sadly, some marriages break up. Either because one person or the other person just doesn't really know how to be married well. Fortunately for you guys, your dad and I, or whoever tells the kids, your mom and I, we love each other very, very much. And that's not something you ever, ever have to worry about. Now, let's assume that the kids are going to worry about it anyway. That their parents' reassurance is not enough. That one of them is a fretter. Maybe it's the 8-year-old, maybe it's the 12-year-old. They're going to fret about it anyway. They're going to think, yeah, but I can't know. If it happens to other people, it could happen to us. They'll find out over time, after the initial revelation that their aunt and uncle are getting a divorce fades, that their mom and dad are pretty solid in their relationship. And they'll see that they have nothing to worry about, even if initially they weren't convinced that they had nothing to worry about. I think that is something that my wife and I often reinforced to our kids when they heard of or knew one of their friends' parents getting divorced or someone getting divorced that was somewhat in our lives, we reinforce to them. It's sad and tragic that happens to some marriages, but guys, that is one thing you do not have to worry about. And to the degree that they saw that their mom and dad did not have these obvious hard-hitting conflicts, they were reassured. So that's what I would say on that, Grandma. All right, let me see what else we got here. Go down a little further. Spin. Let's try that one. Dr. Ray, I was listening to your radio broadcast some weeks back, and I was fascinated by the research study about the children and the number of toys they have to play with. I would be tickled pink if you could send me the link to that study. I did. I copied it and I sent it to her. I would like to look at it and see it in more depth. Actually, though, I was not surprised Let me back up here and tell you what the study said. These researchers, I think this was over a period of 6 months, I think, if I remember my details. They gave the kids four toys. And they weren't toys that were specific. In other words, like some kind of device or something. No, they were, I think it was blocks, maybe a truck or something to play with, a little car, something that could be used creatively. Drawing, paper, and coloring pencils, something. The other kids were inundated with toys. They got as many toys as they wanted, and their parents got as many toys as they wanted. At the end of the six-month period, surprising, and this was surprising to me too, because I didn't think IQ, at least as it was measured by whatever test they used, would move that much. But they found a significant raise in the kids' IQ who only had the four toys. And as I said, they were generic kinds of toys. I don't remember what they were, but I remember thinking, oh yeah, this would allow an awful lot of creative play for these kids. She says, I was surprised that the IQ was affected. Yeah, so was I, to tell you the truth. My eight siblings and I grew up with very few toys. And I recall spending hours with a Tonka truck, a doll, blocks, crayons, and paper, or mom's spoons to dig in the dirt. Yeah, that was generally the idea behind the toys that these kids got. It's just kind of stuff that you could use, and you had to decide how to use it to amuse yourself. We had our 10 children at one point were 12 and under. We had one toy box for all the toys. Part of it was because I didn't like stuff. Part of it was because I didn't want my kids to develop an entitled mentality that all kinds of stuff was going to keep coming at them no matter what. And part of it was I realized, yeah, be creative. Go out and we had a little field next to us. Go in the field. Go in the field and build a fort with sticks. Find stuff. They had a wiffle ball and bat and some tennis balls that they amused themselves with for hours. Yeah, I think one of the toys was a ball, some type of ball. Now, she goes on to talk about what was more common. This sounds like a person who's older. She said this, trees, bikes, tags in the evening with the neighborhood kids at the cemetery at the end of our street were favorites. We had rules of respect. Yeah, it sounds like she was speaking of another time and generation when that kind of outside play was much more common. We used to play flashlight tag. You remember flashlight tag? Where at night when it got dark, if you hit somebody with the flashlight with the beam, you laid the flashlight down, you took off. And there were only certain places you could go, so obviously you didn't run three blocks away, but you played flashlight tag. Eric says he wasn't allowed to go out at night. Yeah, well, they did. Eric, they didn't know what kind of mischief you would cause in your neighborhood, and they got so tired of the cops coming to your house, especially in the morning, okay? So, yeah, that was the point. And I think, you know, the follow the money, if you will, because the marketing on all these toys, this will raise your kids' IQ, this will make them more creative, this will keep them occupied for hours. And what they found in this study is that the more toys the kids had, the more they bounced. The quicker they got dissatisfied with a particular toy or gadget and moved on. They called it multitasking with toys. They didn't stick with any one thing. What's next? What can I play with next? Nothing really held their attention all that long, as opposed to these few generic type toys. And what it did is sustained attention and, according to the researchers, raised IQ. Fascinating.
EWTN Family Prayer with Father Joseph.
Family, a prayer that we pray together is a powerful prayer. So please pray together with me, our EWTN Family Prayer. Today we pray for those who have diabetes. Almighty God, we worship you, our Father. And we pray this day for those who suffer with diabetes. Look upon your children with this illness and grant them relief. Give them patience and the grace of perseverance in taking care of their health. Show them the way to physical and spiritual well-being. Let their cry come to your ears and bring them healing in mind and body and soul. We ask this in the holy name of Jesus, your Son. Amen.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John 14. This is Jesus in the upper room with the disciples before he's going out to his sacrifice of himself for our salvation. And Philip says to the Lord, "Show us the Father and we'll be satisfied." Jesus looks at Philip and says, "Philip, have I been with you all this time? Don't you understand? When you see me, you're looking at the Father." In fact, only two people throughout human history have given rise to the question, not who is he, but what is he? The two people are Buddha and Jesus. Buddha's answer was, don't come to me, don't look to me, look to my doctrine, look to what I teach. Jesus's answer was, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Jesus is explicitly claiming to be God.
Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. I had kids. When I was a kid, I had two friends. I had two friends. They were imaginary, and they only played with each other. That hurt. Okay, this is E-Person Monday. Let's see what this one is. My husband had an anxiety attack 10 years ago. Commonly known as a panic attack. He was moving homes, changing jobs. I was expecting a baby. And we'd only been married a year. After two major attacks, he had a few mild ones until the other day. Now, let me stop there and make some comments here. Not unusual when you have this ongoing level of stress that the body says, enough, enough, and it reacts. It spikes into an anxiety surge. If there's no underlying physical problem, and in most cases there's not, but you can comfort yourself by checking it out through medical exams. It's panic that is based upon nothing. There's no danger here. And the anxiety isn't dangerous. You're just experiencing your body's reaction to danger when there is no danger. That's what a panic attack is. Now, it's not unusual to have it occur out of nowhere. It seems out of nowhere. But now, as the wife is looking back on this, she said, oh, boy, look what was going on at the time. Got it. So because of that, he had one. Then he had two others, which is not uncommon. Why? Because panic attacks really scare people.
Oh, that's real insightful, Dr. Ray.
What I mean by that is the anxiety eruption is very uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. But the interpretation of the anxiety eruption is what keeps it in the forefront of fear. In other words, I had one. When's the next one going to happen? And that in and of itself makes the next one more likely. She said he had two, and then he had a few mild ones after that. It sounds like it was tapering away, which is not unusual. That can happen if you don't panic about the panic. In time, it kind of fades. Now, she says, until the other day. Again, stressors entered his life. Changing jobs, house full of kids, four boys, girl on the way. He doesn't take meds. And here's the big but. But he is having residual anxiety from the big one. That's right, it can linger. It's a low level of anxiety, which is, I just don't want that to happen again. I just don't want that to happen again. It's terrifying. It's unpleasant. What does it mean? What will it mean to my life? Will I ever function normally again? All of this is a brew percolating in your head. And he fears another one is around the corner. That is called anticipatory anxiety. When will it hit me again? He is in good health, Dr. Ray. What are some suggestions to avoid another big one? Well, short of not filling his life with demands, and that doesn't sound like that's possible, given that he's just simply living a, I don't want to say a high-stress existence, but a high-demand existence, okay. Then my best suggestion, and this isn't just mine, this is research-supported, the best way to avoid a recurrence is to not worry about a recurrence. Well, how am I going to do that? You can do that if you recognize that there is nothing in the anxiety attack that is going to hurt you. You're not having a heart attack. You're not going to lose your mind. You're not going crazy. If it happens, you take some nice, easy belly breaths. You sit down somewhere, or you continue what you're doing is even better, just to continue what you're doing, because you'll burn off some of the energy of the anxiety, and it will pass. And you know it will pass. Because I would ask him, well, are you still having anxiety right now? You have a panic attack right now? He'd say, no. I said, right. It passed. It went away. They always go away. Somebody comes in my office and I say, would you give me an anxiety attack right now? Could you? Just prompt one up here? They'd look at me real funny like, no, I can't. I go, exactly. Because it kind of comes out of nowhere. And it disappears. If you do nothing, it disappears. Now, in his case, he's still got this lingering echo of anxiety because he's just nervous, like, what's wrong with me? What if this happens again? When I had mine, which was during practice, I've spoken about it on this program, and if you don't know that, you weren't listening, so you know who you are. It was because of low blood sugar, and I found that out later, after having eaten at a restaurant, and I realized I hadn't eaten for 24 hours. I had low blood sugar, and it kicked off an anxiety attack during practice. Just came out of nowhere. Now, had I not known that this was really just a panic attack for some reason, and I was going to find out the answer eventually here, I would have developed some anticipatory anxiety. Well, if it happened during practice, it could happen during a game, you know. What if I'm at bat? I mean, you can't bat when you have that level of anxiety, when you're breathing that hard and your heart's racing like that and you feel lightheaded. Well, how could I bat? And what if the score's tied? And what if it's the last inning? And what if? And if that anticipatory anxiety would have kicked in after that, what I called a perplexing anxiety attack during practice, I'd have been in a little bit of trouble here. Because I'd have been real nervous before the games, thinking, please don't happen again. Please don't happen again. Please, please, please don't happen again. And that would have made it much more likely to happen again. So what's happening with him is, if he would say, I had a couple of panic attacks that I now can explain because of the circumstances in my life. I didn't know what they were at the time, so they made me very, very panicky, if you will, because you have to interpret them. If it happens again, I know that I am probably in a stressful period, and I'm probably scared of it. I'm anxious about being anxious, and that's what'll keep it potentially next to me. So, given that, if he could get to the point where he realizes this is nothing to fear, I can handle it. I won't have to gut through it. I'll just flow through it. If, in fact, that will lessen the chances this will happen again, and over time, it'll probably disappear totally.
Is it impossible to live Jesus Christ's command that the marriage bond be indissoluble? No, says the Catholic Catechism. The Lord has not placed too heavy a burden on the shoulders of a married couple. By coming to restore the order of creation disturbed by sin, Christ himself gives the strength and grace to live marriage in the new dimension of the reign of God. By following Christ, renouncing themselves, and taking up their crosses, spouses will be able to receive the original meaning of marriage and live it with the help of Christ. St. Paul, in a letter to the Ephesians, emphasizes this when he admonishes men to love their wives as Christ loved the church. For this reason, Paul says, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jangle.
What is the fundamental direction of your spiritual life? Are you moving closer to God or away from Him? Understanding the fundamental direction of a person's spiritual life is key to discernment. Being able to identify the spiritual direction of our lives is a necessary step before beginning a process of discernment. Father Timothy Gallagher writes, Ignatius thus highlights this all-important fact, to discern correctly which spirit is working in a person's heart, and so to know what we should accept or reject, we must first identify the fundamental direction of that person's spiritual life. The first rule in St. Ignatius of Loyola's 14 Rules for the Discernment of Spirits gives us an opportunity to consider anew the direction of our spiritual journey. Take a moment to consider what is the fundamental direction of your spiritual journey.
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
Dr. Ray, do you have a bucket list? Yeah, I do. It's pretty basic. My bucket list is keep breathing. It's pretty much what I've narrowed it down to. This is Kentucky Fried Chicken, huh, Eric? All right, let me get to another one of my e-persons here. Dear Dr. Ray, my name is Mary. Married 26 years. Six kids. I don't work. My husband does, but it's a struggle financially. Yeah, you got one income with six kids. Definitely. Oldest is my son, and then five beautiful girls. I'm very blessed. Three oldest are 26, 24, and 19. And all three oldest, she says, have fallen into the entitlement zone. I never heard it put that way, the entitlement zone. Let me stop right there. It is very difficult to not have some degree of entitlement, especially given the way we live, particularly so with the younger generation. Those of you who are older, you still had times when you were younger that a lot of material things didn't come easy, but we live so well now. Everybody has air conditioning, everybody has all the food they need, everybody has all kinds of cars, everybody has television screens that are 72 inches or okay, if you want to get by really, really little and rough it, you got a 42-inch one. We just have so much materially, and our kids are the benefit of so much materially. It just is. And what it does, and I don't know any way around this, because obviously I'm not going to live like a hermit, but my kids grew up very comfortably. Even though we did everything we could do to keep them from being materially spoiled, they still got a lot. They still lived very nicely. Very. So that entitlement mentality comes when you don't have to strive and struggle somewhat to grow up. Okay. I have lots of questions, but I'll stick to the current issue, my daughter, who is 19. Currently, she lives with us. She works and is going to community college. Other than paying for her car insurance and cell bill, she doesn't contribute monetarily on a regular basis. We all decided this so she could save for college. However, her behavior has been extremely disrespectful. Now, I'd sure like some details on that. Extremely is a strong word. Is she defiant? Is she disruptive? Is she influencing the younger kids? Example, Dr. Ray, we needed our van fixed. I've been saving up to fix it for a while, but it couldn't wait. Needed about $1,500 worth of work. I had $500, and we asked to borrow from her the other $1,000. Apparently, this young lady has her savings account, and she's been saving because her parents have really not asked much from her monetarily. She works, so she's been saving. Okay. And we intended to pay her back. I mean, she probably wants 12% interest, right, Ma? I have asked her to help in the past, and I always have gotten met with disrespect. So I'm assuming that means she says no. And she probably says, I work and I go to school, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And why are you asking this of me? I've noticed that mindset among many in the younger generation, which is, if I have a job of some type, don't expect me to help around the house, too. Don't expect me to do extra because I work for a living. Okay. We've never asked her for this much. The most we've asked is $200. Now, here's a question I can't answer. And in essence, I don't want to answer because I don't, it's bad enough that Mom is questioning herself on this. She says, were we right in asking her to help pay for the car? Mom, what is right in this circumstance is what you decide to do as a parent. There would be many parents who wouldn't ask a dime of her. I personally wouldn't agree with that. But they have the right to do that. You have the right to say the van needs fixed. We don't have the money. We've been allowing you to live here and trying to help you to save money. Now we need to borrow from you. And if she essentially says, get out of my face. What's your decision, Mom? What is your decision? How disrespectful is she? How uncooperative is she? Most parents in your situation are not going to go for the big option, which is meet certain conditions or you can't live here. They're afraid. They won't do it. Where's she going to go? What's she going to do? How's she going to make ends meet? She can't live on her own, etc., etc. So what they do is they allow and accept an enormous amount of mistreatment. This is so very, very common. My older two have moved out, and they too have a sense of entitlement. In other words, I'm reading into what Mom is saying here is, Mom, you got to help us out, but we're not going to return any of that. And then here's where I think Here's where I think she's really struggling. What have I done wrong? And how do I stop it from happening with my last three kids? I'm not so sure, Mom, you've done anything wrong. I think it is a risk of living in our culture. We are by far the most comfortable, most materially acquisitive culture the world has ever, ever, ever seen. Most recently, the stunning surprise of the soccer players and their fans from other countries at what America has, the size of our stores, our restaurants, the size of our portions. They're shocked. Well, they think it's wonderful because they don't have that in Europe. And, of course, Europe is supposed to be all developed countries for the most part. But they're coming here and they're just stunned. One guy said he couldn't believe the size of a Costco. It was bigger than his whole village at home. Another guy said they bring food before you even order. They went to Texas Roadhouse. They got bags of peanuts, as many as they wanted. They got bread brought to him, and he said, I didn't order bread. And the server said, no, the bread's free, as much as you want. They were stunned. These are people from, in many places, what would be considered developed countries. And looking at what we have, and the byproduct of that with our kids, especially our younger kids. Many of you listening to me right now, you still had a certain sense of struggling when you were growing up. You sure had a lot of chores, or maybe you just didn't get much. My dad worked in a factory. We had one small car, had no air conditioning till I was 19 years old, and then we had a box air conditioning in a room. It's where we slept when it really got hot. Now, I'm not bemoaning any of this because we were solidly middle class. But now that would definitely be an aberration in much of our culture anyway. So because of that, I'm not sure that some amount of entitlement isn't at all what you did wrong, Mom. Maybe you underestimated how easy and comfortable you made it for the kids. And maybe that would be my suggestion to you with the remaining three kids, the younger three. Don't make it so easy. Require of them chores, working, doing things for you around the house. We tried not to create a sense of entitlement among our kids. For example, we had 10 kids and we had 3 bikes, and you had to share them. We were not going to give a bike to each kid. That's not going to happen. Did they resent it as they got older? I don't know. They don't bring it up. And I know they looked around and thought, man, not only do we not each have a bike, but Dad buys used bikes, and my friends all have the greatest, latest. Yeah. Some of them may think, well, it's because we had 10 kids. We don't have very much. That wasn't it. My wife and I struggled a lot with how much to give materially to at least lower the risk of I'm entitled. So I would say learn a lesson from the three oldest and back off on the material stuff and all the perks and all the goodies. It's one way to try it. May not work, because we do live in a culture that more or less says you are entitled to have these things. And if you don't get them, then you're being ripped off. Yeah, it's a lot harder. A lot harder to form the virtue of gratitude over the characteristic of entitlement. Dr. Ray.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com.
Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Life is hard and we have to struggle against so much, including the ongoing struggle against our own sinfulness. And sometimes we just want to say, no more, I'm done. But God isn't done with you. I'm Dr. Marcus Peter, and in my book, Not Finished Yet, I can show you how God has already begun a wondrous work in you, in each of us, and only needs your cooperation. Find Not Finished Yet and all of our other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
This Ave Maria program brought to you in part by the following nonprofit.
One of the greatest threats to your family isn't a disaster or a virus, but addiction. In nearly every family and every pew, someone is silently struggling. Beginning July 11th, Shalom World TV and the iThirst Initiative present Unshackled, a powerful new series on the Catholic Church's response to the addiction crisis, bringing together leading voices to discuss real healing. Stream it free at shalomworld.org or on the Shalom World app today.
Let me give you a statistic. Now, this is corrected, obviously, for currency diversity across cultures. If your assets total $500,000 or more, now, many people have close to that much just in their home that's paid off, not to mention a retirement account or anything else. But if your assets total $500,000 or more, you're in the top 1% of the world. If your assets total $100,000 or more, now that would include pretty much everybody listening to this program. You probably have that much equity. If you own your home, you have that much equity in your home. Even a brand new car is 50 grand. So 100,000 or more in total assets, total now, you're in the top 8% of the world. Let's drop it to 50. $50,000 in assets. I got to believe pretty much everybody listening to this program has at least $50,000 in assets. You're in the top 13% of the world. 87% are below you. Let's drop it to 10,000. Let's drop it to 10,000. Now, most teenagers have that. Let's just drop it to 10. 10K. You have assets totaling 10K. You're in the top one-third of the world. $4,210. If you have assets totaling $4,210, you're at the halfway mark of wealth in the world. Now, again, it can be argued, wait a minute, Dr. Ray, come on, cost of living in various places, etc., etc. True. But I think these particular numbers generally hold true. And that's one indication of materially how well off we are compared to the world. Here's another one from C.S. Lewis here. This was he wrote this in the letters of C.S. Lewis to Arthur Greaves. I'd never met that, read that one. Nobody who gets enough food and clothing in a world where so many are hungry and cold has any business to talk about misery. Whoa. Well, come on, C.S. What about emotional misery here? What about frustrations in life? What about relationship misery? I think he was alluding to the fact that be very careful about talking about physical material want compared to, again, the world. It's hard for us to look beyond our horizon. I look around me at the people who live around me, at the people that I know directly. And yeah, okay, I have more than some of them materially, and I have less than some of them materially. So I just sit there thinking, okay, well, I'm the norm. No, I'm not. I am well above the norm worldwide, and I'm well above the norm in all who ever lived. Far, 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 far above. And I got to keep telling myself that, because otherwise I can slip into an entitlement mind. Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. I appreciate the company. Good Lord permitting. Tomorrow we'll talk to you on The Doctor Is In. Walk with God. That's the walk you want.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.